That was Martha Wainwright. There's a photograph of a soldier hanging not far from the front door of Dave's house. It's not a large photo, and it hangs where the light isn't good, so it's easy to miss if you don't know it's there. It's in a wooden frame, a brown wooden frame. The photo itself is also brown, sepia, in the old style. The soldier, a soldier from the First World War, is wearing the uniform of the Canadian Expeditionary Force. He's standing in front of a chestnut tree, and behind him, resting on the trunk of the tree, is a bicycle. Though he's staring at the camera, this soldier, it's difficult to read his expression. You might think you read pride on his face, or perhaps resolve. He is standing erect, and he isn't smiling, but that's what soldiers do. And you could just as easily read fear, or as Dave has sometimes thought, confusion, the face of a man puzzled to find himself by this tree in front of this camera. Whatever it is the soldier was feeling when the picture was taken, Dave has over the years seen all of these emotions in his face. Pride, resolve, fear, and confusion, all of these and others. The man in the picture has no connection to Dave in any conventional sense. It's not a photo of his father or of his grandfather. It's not his uncle standing in front of that chestnut tree, wherever that tree was. It's not any member of Dave's family. Yet Dave might tell you, if you asked, that no other photograph he owns has the power to move him the way this photograph does. Sometimes he found himself staring at the photo, the way a man stares at his own image in a mirror. Sometimes he even talks to it. "I won't be long," he might say quietly on his way out the door. The soldier in this picture is Corporal Eddie Ginger Matheson, 53187, Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. The chain of circumstance that ended with Ginger Matheson's photo hanging in the hall of Dave's house began some 60 years ago. The first link of the chain was forged on an August afternoon in 1941 when Ginger Matheson's wife, his widow, dropped a postcard on the top of her bureau and ran downstairs to tell the coal man to be careful where he parked his wagon. The last time the coal man had come, his wagon wheels had run through her flower garden and laid waste to a row of pansies. The postcard that Georgia Matheson dropped as she ran downstairs was the last thing Georgia had received from Ginger before he left England to join the front. Georgia had kept that postcard in her dresser drawer since it arrived in the afternoon mail in the summer of 1915. From time to time, over the 26 years since she received it, Georgia would take the card out of her dresser and read the 44 words written on the back carefully to herself. Although after 26 years she knew those words by heart, and she didn't need the card anymore to wonder what her Ginger might have been thinking when he wrote it, and what he might have been doing during the moments before he wrote it and the moments after, and whether he had put it in his pocket and carried it with him for a while, or whether he had dropped it in a post box as soon as he had finished writing it. Georgia had wondered all this about the postcard and more. She had wondered about the stamp, for instance, a British tuppenny stamp. Ginger's lips would have touched the stamp, and over the years, in a gesture of first pain and then wistful regret and finally habit, Georgia always put her lips to the stamp before returning the card to the drawer in her dresser where she kept it. On this day, however, this August afternoon in 1941, Georgia did not put the card away when she ran downstairs to scold the coal man. In her hurry, she dropped it on her bureau. She dropped it without bringing the stamp to her lips, and she ran downstairs. As soon as she left the room, Georgia's cupboard door swung cautiously open, and Georgia's 5-year-old grandson, Gus, peered out. Gus had hidden in the clothes cupboard so his grandmother would not know he had been playing in her bedroom. He was not supposed to do that, but Gus was on a mission. He was after his grandmother's silver hand mirror, which fascinated him, and which he had been told several times he was not to touch. But now she was gone, he crossed the room quickly, and it was while Gus, 5 years old, was struggling to get onto the top of his grandmother's bureau so he could get at that silver hand mirror that he unknowingly knocked the last postcard his grandfather had written home before he went to the front, knocked it off the bureau, and as fate would have it, behind the baseboard on the bedroom wall so it was never seen again, not by his grandmother Georgia anyway, who didn't notice the postcard was missing for several weeks. And when Georgia realized the postcard had disappeared, she looked everywhere for it. For weeks she looked, not sure at all when she had last seen it. No one saw the postcard for 40 years, not until Georgia was long dead and gone. No one saw it until a Friday night in 1981. Morley was pregnant, and Dave was fixing up the smallest of the three bedrooms on the second floor of their new house, getting it ready for the daughter, who he believed at the time was going to be a son, a boy they'd call Robert. On Monday morning, men were coming to sand the floors in this bedroom, so Dave was removing the baseboards on that Friday night so the men could do the job properly. It was after 10 at night, and Dave was bent over and prying at a reluctant section of the baseboard when the postcard fell at his feet like a leaf in autumn. The postcard had a picture of a British country pub on one side, a British pub on a winding country road, the Fraser Arms. On the other side, in black ink, in a tight and controlled script, there were 44 words. "My darling Georgia, it's a glorious day. Bill and I on weekend leave and here in Nottingham to visit Aunt B. They say we'll be shipping off soon, finally getting our turn at the big show. Isn't it grand? Love, your Ginger." Dave took the card to Morley, who was downstairs watching Hill Street Blues. And when the commercials began, Dave showed her the card and they read it together, and they wondered together about Georgia and Ginger, who they could see by the address had lived in their house at one time. And then Dave put the card on the coffee table and his hand on his pregnant wife's belly. When it was time for bed, Dave took the postcard upstairs with him and put it in his bureau, in the cluttered drawer where he puts things that he doesn't want to throw out, small things that have no other place. There's something about the ghosts who live in the house where you live. There is some kind of an inexpressible pull between the people who have lived and loved under the same roof as you have. The older you get and the longer you live in a place, the more the ghosts who live with you will call your name and the more you will hear them. Ginger Matheson called to Dave again 12 years after the night Dave had pulled the baseboard off the bedroom wall. He called next on a rainy night in November, the wind gusting around the neighborhood, the rain pelting the window panes, and Dave sitting up late with Sam, his second child, who had an earache. Dave was sitting in that same room, holding a hot water bottle to his son's ear, when for no apparent reason he remembered the card in his bureau drawer. "They say we'll be shipping off soon, finally getting our turn at the big show. Isn't it grand?" Dave dug the postcard out the next morning and took it with him to work. A few weeks later, on an afternoon when he was alone in his store with nothing to do, he wrote a letter to the Department of National Defense and asked if they would send him a copy of the war records of one Ginger Matheson, who had written a postcard telling his beloved Georgia that he was off to the big show. Dave didn't know if the Department of Defense would share a man's military records with anyone who asked, but he decided it was worth a try. What happened was the Department of Defense forwarded Dave's letter to the Archives of Canada, and 4.5 months later, Dave received an official-looking envelope in the mail, and inside the envelope he found a photocopy of Corporal Ginger Matheson's attestation papers, the form Ginger had filled out when he had enlisted, which he had apparently done on the 14th of July in 1914. Ginger Matheson, 5 feet 10 inches, 156 pounds, brown eyes, auburn hair, Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. Dave paperclipped the 2 pages the Archives of Canada had sent him onto the back of Ginger's postcard and returned it to the drawer in his bureau. And he didn't think of Ginger Matheson again until an autumn afternoon 4 years later. Dave remembers it was an autumn afternoon because he was raking leaves when he noticed the man and the woman watching him from the far side of the street. They were maybe 10 years older than him. The man who was beginning to go bald had his hands jammed in the pockets of his beige windbreaker. The woman who was wearing a bright red car coat would occasionally point at his house. Dave thought she might be a real estate broker. When the man took his hands out of his pockets and pointed at Stephanie's bedroom, Dave crossed the street. "May I help you?" he asked. He was still holding his rake. "Please excuse us," said the woman. "My husband grew up here." "Not grew up," said the man. "That was his bedroom," said the woman, pointing to the room at the front of Dave's house. "It used to be my grandmother's house," said the man. "My mother and I lived here with her during the Second War. I was 5 years old. My father was overseas. We lived here for 3.5 years. 4.5, said the woman. "That was my bedroom," said the man. He was pointing to the front bedroom. "What was your grandmother's name?" asked Dave. "Matheson," said the man, "Georgia Matheson." It took a moment for Dave to make the connection. "Georgia Matheson was your grandmother," he said. "It was the final link in the chain." And then he said, "I have something that you should see. Don't go away, I'll be right back." And Dave ran across the street and into his house, and when he returned, he handed Gus the postcard that he had found behind the baseboard the night he was preparing Stephanie's room for the Sanders. Gus turned it over in his hand several times before he read the message. "My grandfather sent this card," he said finally. He was examining it ever so carefully. "I never met him. I've never seen his handwriting before." He handed the card to the woman in the red car coat who was standing beside him. And when she handed it back to her husband, Dave said, "Would you like to see the house? I was just going to fix some lunch." "Thank you, but it's all right," said the man, handing the postcard back. "We'd love to," said the woman. "My name is Molly. This is my husband, Gus." And so they went in. And they went upstairs and they looked at the top front bedroom where Gus had lived for 4.5 years. "I remember watching the moon through this window," he said. "All I knew, my father was somewhere in Europe, and he was a soldier. I used to think as long as I could see the moon, he could too. And that meant he was okay. I hated cloudy nights. I hated it when it rained. I still don't like the rain. The lady next door was from Holland, I think. May I open the cupboard?" he asked. "Sometimes I used to sit in the cupboard." They looked around some more, and then they went downstairs, Gus and Molly, and they sat at the kitchen table while Dave made a plate of sandwiches, and Morley, who joined them, made coffee. There was an uncomfortable moment of silence when they all sat down at the table, and then they began to talk, and because the only thing they had in common beside the house was the postcard that was now lying on the table between them, they began with Ginger. "He was born in 1882, said Gus, taking a cheese and tomato sandwich and placing it in the middle of his plate carefully. "He was born in Halifax. He was born the same year Hiram Maxim patented the machine gun. He was really too old to be there," said Gus, putting his sandwich down and reaching for the milk. And when he poured it into his coffee, it spidered into the cup like an oil pigment and paint. "Ah," he said, "real cream." He looked at his wife and smiled. "He was wounded on October the 23rd, 1917, said Gus, stirring his coffee carefully, which was his 35th birthday. "He didn't have a clue what he was getting into. My grandmother told me a bunch of them signed up on the same night. They'd been playing poker. They'd had a few beers. And after the poker game, they just went down and signed up. He'd never handled a gun in his life. We don't know much about what happened to him," said Gus. "He's buried near Calais," said Dave. "Near Calais." "Oui, Mourou," said Gus. "How did you know that?" "I sent for his record," said Dave. "He was killed instantly." "That's what they always used to say," said Gus. "No one wanted people back home to know how horrible it was. It was horrible beyond imagining. So that's what they used to write. He died instantly." "Most of them didn't die instantly. Most of them died of slow, painful infection. The mud they were living in was full of disease. It was full of human excrement and rotting bodies and manure from the horses. If you got an open wound, you could die from a cut in your leg. Gus picked up a sandwich and looked at it, and then he put it down without taking a bite. My grandfather didn't die instantly. He was taken to a hospital in Wimereux. That's where he died. "How do you know?" asked Morley. "After the war, men used to show up at the back door sometimes of this house. Men who had come back from the war and couldn't, they were, I guess they were broken. My grandmother would give them money or make them a sandwich. One day a man showed up who said he knew Ginger. He said he was there the night Ginger died. It was at Passchendaele. The British began the attack at the end of the summer. The Canadians joined in October. They took the Passchendaele Ridge on November the 6th. Before the battle began, British headquarters decided there should be a bombardment to soften up the German position. It was one of the heaviest bombardments of the war. Everyone on the ground told the generals it was a bad idea because the land was so low it was like Holland. There was no drainage. But they launched the artillery anyway, and the place was blasted to hell. It was like a mud moonscape. All the trees were sharded, and the mud was so thick that no one could move. So they put down duck boards, like a wooden sidewalk. And if you wanted to go anywhere, you had to move along the duck boards. Everything was so slick from the rain and the mud, and they could only move at night because of the snipers. And men who slipped off the duck boards in the dark literally drowned in the mud. One man, said Molly. One man died for every inch they gained. Over 16,000 Canadian casualties, said Gus. And then the British lost it about a month later. What about your grandfather, said Morley. He was hit by shrapnel, said Gus. His arm was blown off. He lay in the mud for a day. He hobbled back through the communication trenches to the advanced dressing station on the next night. It was in an old chateau about 400 yards back. Men who died there were buried out the back door, but he didn't die there. His wound got infected and he was taken to the hospital in Wimereux, or that's the story. Gus shrugged and took a bite of his sandwich. They'd been talking for well over an hour, but not one of them had an inclination to stop. Sam came in and saw the sandwiches and tried to reach for one. "You sit down if you're going to eat," said Morley. He sat beside his father, intending to inhale a sandwich or two and then bolt, but he stayed too and listened. Then Molly said, "Have you ever been to Vimy?" Dave and Morley both shook their heads. "No." "It's like a religious experience," said Molly. Gus looked directly at Sam. "It's the most awe-inspiring place I have ever been in my life," he said. "The monument's on the top of a ridge, which is where the Germans were," said Molly. The British and the French had tried to take the ridge before and they had failed, and the task was given to the Canadian Corps in the spring of 1917. "April," said Molly. "April the 9th, said Gus. As you walk towards the monument, said Gus, "you can imagine them shooting at you. And the closer you get, the monument seems to grow in size and detail until you come to the base of it and you can put your hand on it. There are thousands of names on the monument," said Molly. "Names of the dead who were never found," said Gus. "You understand," said Gus, "it's a monument in France just for Canadians. The French gave the land to Canada to remember and honor the Canadian soldiers who died there. They were fighting for us," said Morley. "We spent a whole afternoon up there," said Molly. "And we barely talked to each other," said Gus. "I read some of the names and I cried. I cried for all those young men. You just have no concept of the numbers. They were real people. They were fathers and brothers. They were sons and boyfriends. And so many of them never came home. And standing there that afternoon, it just made it real to me." They were silent again. Dave was thinking, I am so glad that Sam can hear this. This time it was Gus who broke the silence. I remember during the war, he said, he was remembering the Second War now. He was remembering his father's war now, not his grandfather's war. The two wars seemed to have merged in his mind. They seemed to have become the same war, one war. It didn't matter. I remember during the war, said Gus, I played cards with my grandmother in this kitchen. We played snap. Did you ever play snap, he asked, but he didn't wait for an answer. The cards we had were all military cards, he said. They had planes and guns and tanks. All my coloring books were military too, said Gus. And the news on the radio was all war news. I remember thinking, after the war, there'll be no news. Gus and Molly stayed for supper. They never left the table all afternoon. At some point, they exchanged their mugs of coffee for glasses of wine. And Stephanie came, and the sandwiches were replaced with a chicken. The longer they talked, the more the wars got muddled. They talked about Korea, the war no one remembers, and about a boyhood friend of Dave's from Glace Bay who joined the American Army and did a tour in Vietnam. Morley remembered a father from her neighborhood who had gone to the Suez. They were talking, and the kids were listening, Sam and Stephanie. And maybe that was the most important thing. Maybe that was enough. Maybe that's all you can do. You pass on the stories about the men and the women who crossed the ocean in uniforms because that's what you did, or because you believed in something bigger than yourself, or because you'd had a few beers after an afternoon poker game. And so many of them didn't come back. And those of us left here around our tables with our wine and our roast chickens, all we can do is stop every once in a while and hold them in our mind, lest we forget. Gus and Molly stayed until 8:30. And then Gus said we really should go. As they got up, Dave picked up the postcard that he had found behind the baseboard the night he had been preparing the room for the Sanders. And he handed it to Gus. You should take this, he said. It belongs to you. Gus took it and said, thank you, I'd like to have it. Gus sent Dave the photo of his grandfather, Corporal Ginger Matheson, 3 months later. The photo of him standing in front of the chestnut tree with a bike leaning against it. It was already in the brown frame. Dave hung it in the hall by the front door the night he got it. Thank you.